mouth.
Word of 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 mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Since 1990, the percentage of people with no religious affiliation has more than doubled. That includes about 6% of the U.S. population who identify as atheists and agnostics, and nearly 33 million people who say they have no particular religious affiliation. While trying to explain this decline in religiosity, researchers have found one interesting correlation: the rise of the internet. So does the internet spell the fall of religion, or is it more correlation than a cause? Here to take us through the research is Jared Keller, Director of Programming at Policy Mike. His article, "No, the Internet is Not Killing Religion in America," was published in Pacific Standard Magazine. Jared, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first, let's go through Alan Downie's research on the decline of religiosity in America. Now, he's a computer scientist at the Olin College of Engineering. That's in Massachusetts. He analyzed more than two decades' worth of data. What did he conclude?
Well, Downie's primary conclusion may seem intuitive to most people, that the primary factor influencing your relationship with religion is your upbringing. Those of us who are raised in religious households or spend time during our childhoods at religious institutions are more inclined to practice as adults. But Downie also touched upon a really compelling and interesting factor, which is the interplay between the internet and religion. Downie hypothesizes that 5.1 million people have forgone religious affiliation since the 1980s. And Downie sees a strong correlation between this and the rise of internet access, which has exploded over the past 20 years. To give you a sense of this growth in internet access, in 1995, only about 14% of Americans used the internet on a regular basis. Today, it's more like 87%. And a significant portion of that group say they couldn't live without the internet on a daily basis.
So if there is a direct correlation between the prevalence of internet use and the rise of religiously unaffiliated Americans, what does he propose makes the internet so antithetical or even toxic to faith?
Well, I think that you'll have to look back over the past several centuries of the development of Western culture. I mean, since the Enlightenment and the Scientific Revolution, the supremacy of scientific rationality and reason over faith has become more and more enshrined in our culture. We value knowledge far more than faith, leading many people to frame faith kind of as a mere superstition that can be stamped out by the growth of knowledge. And the promise of the internet, since researchers started thinking about this vast storehouse of information starting in 1945 with researcher Vannevar Bush, is they saw it as an explosion of knowledge. You know, we spend our time on the internet chatting with friends and looking at funny pictures, but the fundamental premise is that you can access more and more information and more opinions and analysis and viewpoints than you ever could at any other point in history. And because of this, it's easy to look at the internet as one of the greatest threats to religion, as a juggernaut of knowledge that could come forward and smash down silly superstition.
So the idea that rational knowledge is antithetical to religion.
Yes, those two have been placed in opposition to each other for hundreds of years, since the Enlightenment.
Well, you, Jared, looked over this same research and proposed that correlation does not imply causation, and in fact found other research suggesting that the internet might actually benefit people of faith. Can you explain that?
Of course. Well, there is a body of research published by the Pew Research Center in 2001 that suggested that 25% of internet users had sought out spiritual information online at some point in their lives. More research by Pew over the past decade has explored how the internet is used not to break down communities but actually to strengthen existing communities. Americans aren't bowling alone, to paraphrase Robert Putnam, behind a computer screen at their desk, but they're actually seeking out communities of people with like-minded interests. So the internet can actually be used as a digital church and a digital place of worship for those for whom religion is a primary concern in their day-to-day lives.
Okay, so it may not be the internet's doing, but the decline in religiosity is concurrent with the rise in internet usage. How would you explain that correlation?
Well, I believe that those who are more inclined to forego religious affiliation are also the same subset of people who are more inclined to use the internet on a day-to-day basis. Millennials especially are more inclined to be skeptical of authority and any other dogmatic figures in their lives. There's a burst of political liberalism that comes from the millennial generation being one of the most racially and culturally diverse generations in American history. All of these factors come together to suggest a skepticism of any sort of institutional authority. Now, this doesn't mean that millennials are godless, but it may mean that they're seeking out answers to their own spiritual questions in places that aren't synagogues and churches.
We're talking with Jared Keller. He's director of programming at Policy Mike, among other things, a freelance journalist, and wrote the article, "No, the Internet is Not Killing Religion in America," for Pacific Standard. Well, of course, the Internet is a global phenomenon. Are we seeing the same kind of trends, declines in religiosity outside of the U.S.?
Well, it's interesting. The data suggests that atheism is on the rise globally, but it's unclear whether it's directly correlated with the rise of internet access. Information from the International Telecommunications Union in Geneva shows that the top 20 nations with internet penetration rate aren't the same as the top 20 nations for declining religiosity around the world. Atheism is the strongest in Northwest Europe, in countries such as Scandinavia and those in the former Eastern Bloc, but those countries don't necessarily have the highest rate of internet access. Now, it's also hard to draw inferences from data about the United States, since the U.S. and its relationship with religion, especially in an institutional sense, are, for lack of a better phrase, exceptional.
Well, as we know, the Pope has a huge Twitter following. So, you know, the signs to religious organized religion may be a little mixed. Should religious institutions be worried about the internet at all?
I think that if you're a member of an institution with a large amount of political and social power, any major innovation which changes the structures of power in the broader society are going to be cause for alarm. However, it's worth noting that the Vatican has done an exceptional job of integrating digital media and the internet into its mission. The Vatican has launched portals and a cornucopia of apps for believers. The Pope, as you noted, has a tremendous Twitter following, and His Holiness even has a social media manager. Now, it's worth noting, and this is a great anecdote, that one of the greatest political and social revolutions in modern history was spurred on by Martin Luther's 95 Theses, which, once nailed to the doors of the All Saints Church in Wittenberg, Saxony,
and went viral.
Yeah, it essentially went viral across the Holy Roman Empire. And the reason it did so was because of the printing press. So it's interesting that modern technology can present an existential risk to institutions which wield clout in the minds and hearts of citizenry, but it can also be another way for people to reconnect with the issues and the values that matter most to them.
So we draw from this that religiosity is a very complicated matter that can be attributed to a number of different factors. But it doesn't seem like the internet is the antichrist or the faith killer, does it?
Certainly not. And you know, part of my motivation for writing this article was that we have a tendency to speak of the internet in very broad, aggressive terms. We talk about the internet making us dumber and making us more silly and less inclined to take things seriously and more godless. But the internet isn't this enormous monster, this large leviathan skulking across the countryside and making us do things. It's a tool. And like any other tool, it emphasizes the best and worst of human beings. So for those for whom religious observance and religious affiliation are incredibly important, the internet can be a catalyst for further community. And for those who are maybe skeptical, the internet can emphasize that skepticism. But we can't think of the internet as a silver bullet that rolls up in your neighborhood and demolishes churches or community centers simply because we see changes in our own behavior.
Well, Jared Keller, great talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jared Keller, director of programming at Policy Mike, also a freelance journalist. His work has appeared in The Atlantic, Al Jazeera America, among others. We found his article, "No, the Internet is Not Killing Religion in America," on Pacific Standard. We have a link to read it for yourself. It's at wordofmouthradio.org. 1776, 1812, 1914, 1989, 2001. Some years just stick in the popular psyche. When Word of Mouth continues, the rise of anno history and the pitfalls of treating a year as a celebrity. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The great man school of history is getting bumped off of its pedestal. Bulging biographies of influential men are so last year. Any visit to your local bookstore will convince you that the great year theory is now selling and 1914 is in. On the front display table, Max Hastings' Catastrophe, Europe Goes to War, 1914. Christopher Clark's The Sleepwalkers, How Europe Went to War, 1914. Mark Bostridge's The Fateful Year, England, 1914, and a host of other titles are making 1914 a new celebrity. Simon Reed Henry is a reader in geography at Queen Mary, University of London. He is concerned that by focusing on a single year, this new crop of anno histories may miss the larger historical context. Simon Reed Henry, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be with you.
Can you remind us briefly of this idea of the great man school of history, what it means and when it was developed?
Right. Well, this was sort of a Victorian conceit or style of history, I suppose you might say, in which, you know, the actions of charismatic leaders particularly and individuals were seen to really shape historical events. It was very much the idea of an individual personality imposing themselves upon history.
You are now observing another, I guess, approach or perspective or even phenomenon, anno history. What is that?
Yeah, right. Well, anno history is not my phrase. This is the phrase of an American scholar named Graeber. And he sort of points out, and I take it further a little bit tongue-in-cheek, I suppose, given that we have this year in 2014 so many anniversaries to celebrate or commiserate among ourselves. The idea that perhaps we are putting a bit too much focus on individual years. One understands the publisher's line into this. This is a great way of selling books, not least. But historically speaking, is it the best way of writing about the past? We're confronted by this, plethora of single dates, which seem to tell us their own particular story. And I suppose my point is that story gets a little too easily condensed. It becomes simply a case of learning the lessons of history, as that old canard has it. Mm. And that can be a little bit more dangerous.
Well, focusing on a single year, I think, gives us some sort of anchor. You know, there's this way station in this long stretch of the past. But what do you think gets missed when we focus on a single year?
Yeah, I think what you say is actually an important point. And there's no doubt that, you know, there are some years where important things happen. 1492 would be another example. And actually, I mentioned this one in the article. But often the way to think about those years is not necessarily as a constellation of great events. And here we are back again at the great men of history school. But as, you know, turning points or where particular sorts of histories that were underway before switched somehow or were displaced into a different set of processes. So rather than the discovery of the new world, which is what 1492 is about, we might instead want to think about the relations between different parts of the world and whether Europe's discovery of the new world was the only discovery of that particular period, whether it was the most important one, and whether it was the one that's actually led us to the best possible future. These are the sorts of questions that I think get lost and left out of a particular, as you say, anno history focus on one particular year.
Well, I'm not thinking that 1913, the book, would sell particularly well.
No, that's exactly right. But often things happen in years outside of those key dates and we miss them. And this is another part of it.
Well, what are some of your ideas then, Simon, about challenging the significance of the individual year or taking a more panoramic view?
Right. Well, I'm a geographer by training and by profession, which is not to say that we don't deal in a good deal of history or have a lot to say and do with our history colleagues. But one of the sort of geographer's classic approaches to things is to think in the bigger picture, in the round, and to try to see how processes develop over time rather than individual events dominating any particular story. It's very easy to tell a story, a narrative around events. It's actually much harder, but not impossible, and often more important, to tell a story of process, of how things gradually take us from one set of circumstances to another. So, for example, how processes of the formation of empires lead one to 1914 and the events that happen in the Great War. And that isn't necessarily a process of, you know, determining whose empire was the best or the worst. Was it the Russians that were the most imperial, or the Germans, or the British? But really about questioning empire as a process itself. And that, of course, brings in whole other parts of the world. And this is why geographers are particularly interested in it, because whenever we talk of dates, we're talking from a particular position. You know, we're talking about 1914 as important to us in Europe. You say 1913 isn't important. Perhaps 1913 is important in other people's histories. And again, it's very easy to leave those out of the picture.
Well, one thing I found it so interesting in your article is distinguishing between looking back at the past and a past. Can you elaborate on that for us?
Yeah, this is, I mean, I think, again, this is something that geographers are particularly attuned to, which is the idea of historical possibilities that either get closed off or not even opened up and made into a discussion. So one of the problems of having a particular year is it becomes something you either want to celebrate or resist, which falls into a very sort of binary way of understanding the past. And that only opens ourselves up to so many futures. You know, one wants to always think of possible ways of doing things better in the future. And remembering the lessons of the past isn't necessarily the only way of doing that. Remembering which histories got closed off, that's also another way of doing it. And I think that's something that we could, you know, profitably focus on in our histories going forward.
Well, it's so interesting now that Russian troops are lining up, retreating and lining up again at the borders of Ukraine. Talk is bubbling up again of something happening, you know, akin to the flashpoint of the Archduke being assassinated in Sarajevo. Is there a problem with this kind of equivalency of this 100 years?
Yeah, I think so. A lot of loose talk, in truth. It happens in part because it's occurring right now, you know, during this period of anniversary celebration. It focuses people's minds. So in some ways, it's proof of what I'm saying. But, you know, there are other ways people are talking a lot about, you know, is this time for a new era of containment and so forth? Containment, of course, was the Cold War era geopolitical solution to the problem of the Soviets. But, you know, again, it's always possible in history, in life, to find some evidence of what you're after. The question is whether the balance of proof, whether the burden of proof really stacks up. And I think in this case, it doesn't.
Simon Reed-Henry, a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
No, my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Simon Reed-Henry reads geography at Queen Mary. That's Queen Mary College at the University of London. He's also author of the book The Cuban Cure. You can find a link to read his article, When Years Are Celebrities. It was published at moreintelligentlife.com. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Some eventful years in world history have inspired piles of historical texts and academic papers. Other years that offer less to the historical narrative have been celebrated in a different way, through music. So tonight I'm gonna party like it's 1999. Whether looking ahead to the future or taking a nostalgic dive into the past, musicians have written countless songs named after one year or another. So we have come up with a little challenge for you. We're going to play a few different songs. See if you can name the band and the year that the song is named after. We bleeped out any reference to the date in the lyrics, so you'll just have to figure it out based on your own recall. I'm going to play along with you and read the answers when we're done. Okay, Taylor, hit it. Oh, easy peasy, got it.
We're about halfway through. How are you doing?
I don't get the third one, that kind of electronic-y one.
Yeah, the no lyrics. So that makes it tough. It was another year for me and you.
Another year with nothing to do. We are the youth and politicians are so sure. Picking
the world that they fought for didn't turn out just like they thought.
Here is your song to sing. All right, so how'd you do?
I'm thinking the first one was David Bowie's 1984.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Okay. And then guessing Tchaikovsky, War of 1812 Overture.
You got it.
The third one, what was that?
The third one was 1991 by Crystal Castles.
The fourth one was Queen in the Year of 39. I not only know the song, I probably know every single word to the song. I was on a Queen bender when I was in middle school. The Stooges, 1969?
You got it.
Okay. Silverchair, I didn't know this one. Silverchair, Anthem for the Year 2000.
Yeah, I had to find some. We had a lot of classic rock in there, so I had to make it a little younger at one point.
Okay, and then Elvis Costello, 45.
You got it.
All right, so how did you do? You can tell us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouth. And while you're there, tell us about your favorite song that's named after a year. Doesn't have to be 1914. We've heard an awful lot about that. But when we continue, we're going to leap 1 year ahead to bring you the story of Her Land. That is a utopian novel that was published in 1915. We're going to find out why a book about an all-female society struck such a chord with Americans at the time. But first, the news from 2014.
There's a rebel in a nylon shirt, but the way.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we talked about the significance of 1914. Now we'll skip ahead to 1915 and the publication of Her Land. That's a novel written by an American feminist and social reformer, Charlotte Perkins Gilman. The book laid out a utopian image of the world without conflict, hatred, or men. Her Land is made up entirely of women. While aspirational in tone, the novel reveals a darker side of American society in 1915. Here's more from Backstory with the American History Guys.
The story starts with three male explorers who stumble onto an astonishing sight. Her Land, a nation consisting entirely of women. There are neat towns with sturdy houses, orchards of fruit trees, well-built infrastructure. Most of all, it's clean.
They comment about how there's no dirt, there's no smoke, and there's no noise.
This is Kristen Egan, a professor of English at Mary Baldwin College.
And they just can't get over how clean it is. And they even say things like the streets of Her Land were as dustless as a well-swept floor. And they'll say that the country itself is as neat as a Dutch kitchen.
Egan says the men noticed two kinds of cleanliness right away. There's the domestic side, starched linen and sparkling dishes, but there's also the world outside the home.
In addition to the lack of pollution, the women practice composting, they practice sustainable agriculture, they only grow fruit-bearing trees, they don't bury dead bodies, they only cremate people. It just goes on and on. So they're doing everything they can to create an environment that is sustainable.
The connection between cleanliness and what we've come to call environmentalism has lasted right on up to the present day. Don't litter. Keep America clean. There are slogans we can all get on board with. But in Her Land, the idea of cleanliness also pointed in a darker direction, toward policies that didn't wear quite as well.
To understand this third take on cleanliness, you need to know a little more about Her Land's history. Thousands of years ago, the nation was home to men, too. But the men marched off to fight a war and, well, a sudden volcanic eruption killed them all off. The women back home survived.
And you might assume that a nation full of only women would die out at some point because of some obvious biological limitations. However, this is a utopia, so there's going to be some stretches of the imagination, some miraculous things that have to happen in the plot line in order to have the utopia. And the miraculous thing that happens here is that the women end up suddenly possessing the power to reproduce parthenogenically.
That is to say, they could reproduce without men. Apparently, one of the original women who survived the volcanic eruption was able to become pregnant on her own. She had five daughters, and then each of those daughters was also able to have five daughters of their own. Soon enough, the society was reproducing rapidly and happily without men.
And that gets us to the third form of cleanliness, and perhaps the most sinister form of cleanliness, which is a form of racial cleansing. The women are described as being of Aryan heritage, and they practice eugenics. So we know that they have parthenogenic powers. But some women, if a woman is undesirable in the country, she is asked not to breed. She's essentially asked to abstain from procreating. And if for some reason the undesirable woman decides to procreate anyway, the child will be taken from her. She won't be allowed to raise her own child. And instead, the women of the community that are deemed most fit to raise the child will raise the child. And so in that way, they're performing cleanliness in the sense of racial purity.
Now, the prospect of a eugenicist utopia of this sort sounds really creepy to us today. But in the novel, the three male explorers didn't bat an eyelash at the idea. And they were probably just like most readers of the book. Eugenics was mainstream.
It was clearly a reactionary impulse in response to all the immigrants that were coming into America around the turn of the century, during the Progressive Era. And there was real fear that we would have a kind of racial contamination, that the Anglo-Saxon roots of the race would die out. And in its place, instead, all these immigrants would be taking over and their bloodlines would be taking over the country, so to speak.
Fears of racial contamination were taken seriously enough that in the early 20th century, 33 U.S. states legalized compulsory sterilization for various so-called undesirables. By the 1960s, more than 60,000 Americans had been sterilized. Supporters saw the programs as a step toward a purer society.
There's an interesting ending to the novel. One of the explorers has married a Herlander woman and wants to return to the United States with his bride. But the Herlanders have heard stories about America, stories of pollution and epidemics. So in the end, they ask the happy couple to keep their location secret. Opening up the nation to dirty outsiders is not a risk the Herlanders want to take.
Americans of the era apparently thought along the same lines. In 1917, Congress passed an immigration law that barred, quote, all persons mentally or physically defective, as well as nearly all would-be immigrants from the Middle East and Asia. A few years later, another law dramatically restricted Jewish immigration. The law's purpose was to, quote, maintain the racial preponderance, end quote, of Anglo-Saxon blood. In other words, to keep America clean.
And our thanks to the radio show Backstory with the American History Guys for that. You can find more on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. While the all-female society in Herland did not place a high value on sexual relations, one pharmaceutical company does. In fact, it's banking on it. Last fall, the FDA denied the right to Sprout Pharmaceuticals to market flibanserin, a drug for treating low sexual desire in women. The response from women's groups was swift. Several female academics, members of Congress, and the National Organization for Women charged that given the array of drugs available for male sexual dysfunction, the Fed's refusal to market a drug for diminished drive in women signaled, as one critic put it, blatant medieval sexism. So was it sexism, or as the FDA says, an ineffective drug with the potential for harm? Former Senate investigator Paul Thacker has been following the story and discovered that the furious response to the regulations may have been steered by the drug's manufacturer. Paul Thacker is currently a fellow at the Safra Center for Ethics at Harvard University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Virginia, thanks so much for having me.
So let's go back to that initial rejection of flibanserin. Why did the FDA refuse to allow marketing of the drug?
Well, I think if you either go further back before this incident, which just happened in October, this was actually the third time that this drug had been rejected by the FDA. Prior to this, it had been owned by Boehringer Ingelheim, which is a much larger company, and they had initially run clinical trials to try to get the drug approved to treat depression. It failed on that. They then tried to rebrand it as a drug to treat female sexual dysfunction, and it failed on that. And then it was picked up by a very small company in North Carolina, which is trying to move forward and get the drug approved.
And that's Sprout Pharmaceuticals?
That's Sprout Pharmaceuticals. And essentially the reason why it failed is because it didn't really show enough efficacy. Now, when you looked at how they defined female sexual dysfunction, right, how they defined that, the women that they identified as having the problem had about 2.3 incidents of, I believe what they called it was sexually satisfying incidents, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the women who were on the drug, they bumped up to about 4.3, I want to say is what it was. So that you do get improvement with this drug, right? The problem is that there's also a huge placebo effect, which is around about 3.7, which is, of course, why we understand that aphrodisiacs, you know, seem to work so well, is because there's a high placebo issue when you begin to use drugs to treat sexual issues. And so essentially, FDA said, we just don't think that this is a drug that meets a high enough standard for approval.
So what were some of the specific responses to the decision?
Well, first off, we had earlier this year, there were a lot of women's groups that met with the FDA to discuss the issue. Then we also had a handful of congresswomen that sent a letter to the FDA, you know, demanding answers. And you can also, if you begin to sort of like Google around, you'll see that there were several stories in the press, you know, questioning the FDA about whether their decision was sound or not. And I got in this because I read an initial story which caught my eye because I felt the story was just wrong. And then I just began to look around and I found a whole bunch of other stories claiming the FDA was sexist. And when I see a series of stories, what that told me was there's a push by a PR company designed to bring pressure onto the FDA.
Well, I would love to get to that in a moment. But in your article for Slate, you, for one thing, you show that this is a complicated issue, especially the history and challenges of developing a drug to increase sex drive in women. Can you go through that a little for us, especially the differences between treating male and female sexual dysfunction?
It is somewhat complicated. So with Sprout specifically, the claims that they are making is that they're now like, I think they've increased it to 26 different drugs designed to treat male sexual dysfunction, and there are none to treat female sexual dysfunction. So on its face, it seems that there's some sort of imbalance until you begin to look at what the underlying conditions are that they're discussing. With men, they're talking about inability to get an erection. The issue that they're discussing with females involves wanting to have sex. This is a dramatically different issue because this involves behavioral issues, neurotransmitters, so the chemicals that are in your brain. And so it's a much more complicated issue than a very simple issue of involving plumbing.
You spoke to several medical experts for this story who disputed the very idea that diminished sexual desire for women could be treated with a pill. Tell us where that idea then came from.
If you go back, there have been a couple of books written by a guy named Ray Moynihan, and he worked with a woman named Barbara Mintz. Moynihan is a journalist, and Barbara Mintz, she's an assistant professor at University of British Columbia. And they wrote a book that came out in 2010 called Sex Lies and Pharmaceuticals. And they look at the whole history of this issue and of female sexual dysfunction, among some of the other things. And what they find is that this is an issue that essentially was created by the drug industry. And that's a thing you need to understand about marketing, is that if you want to sell something, the first thing you do is like create the desire for it.
But female sexual dysfunction does exist.
So that is the thing, is that although we have a condition that's created, there probably are, and I don't think any expert out there will tell you, there probably are a number of women that do have a biological problem. And so, of course, I think they're like, just looking at the human condition, there are always biological problems that you can find if you look for them. But the question is it widespread?
We're talking about the complicated story of the FDA refusal to approve a drug for decreased female sexual desire. We're speaking with former Senate investigator Paul Thacker. He wrote an article on Slate.com. He's currently an ethics fellow at Harvard and has dug into the potential ethical overreach of the Sprout Pharmaceutical Company in this case. Tell us more about that. All of this outrage could possibly just be a marketing ploy? I mean, did you find actual evidence showing Sprout Pharmaceuticals' hand in a campaign charging sexism against the FDA?
Well, what you do see is there's no direct evidence. It's just sort of the accumulation of issues. So, for instance, when you see like 5 to 6 stories, as I point out, like Washington Post, American Prospect, and other smaller papers and outlets accusing the FDA of sexism, and you see the same talking points in there repetitively. When you begin to see, like, why did all these women's groups, you know, come together to go to the FDA, and congresswomen, and you look at the if you look at the letters that came from the women's groups, and you compare that next to the letter that came from the congresswomen, they look very similar, you know. And what was interesting is when I went to the company to ask them questions, my response was given to me by Edelman, which is the largest PR company out there for the pharmaceutical industry. So that did kind of confirm to me that my suspicions that there was a huge PR campaign were probably true.
And even more ethically egregious, the fact that some of the authors of these articles charging sexism from the FDA were by consultants paid by Sprout Pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, that was very interesting, because when I went to the National Organization of Women to ask them questions about, you know, why were you guys accusing the FDA of sexism? Why were you trying to get this drug approved? They denied that that's what they were trying to do. And I believed them up until the point when I just was, again, suspicious, and I Googled around and found their letter. And their letter basically was asking the FDA, like, well, we met with you. Again, we don't understand, like, why have you not approved the drug? It's like they obviously were trying to get the FDA to approve the drug. And when I went and asked them questions, they said, well, you should talk to, and they gave me the names of several women that I should contact, female doctors. And either they didn't know or they're not aware, but all of those women are taking money from the drug industry. Again, this is what I worked on when I was on the Senate, was uncovering the sort of unfortunate strong ties between the pharmaceutical industry and doctors, where you begin to read an article in the press or you see someone talk on television and there's no disclosure of the fact of who they're taking money from.
Paul Thacker, you said you did speak to Sprout Pharmaceuticals. What have they said in response to your article specifically?
They have not said anything, and I think that's actually the smart move. What they're doing right now is they're working on more clinical trials, and they're going to go back to the FDA and try to get approval. My guess is that it's not going to happen. They're not going to come up with more evidence that's going to somehow prove the claim that this drug actually works to treat a condition where you have medical experts concerned that it doesn't actually even exist. And I just want to point out another thing. It's really odd for them to claim that the FDA is sexist when the person running the FDA is a woman. And the person in charge of drug approval, Janet Woodcock, is also a woman. And Janet Woodcock, if you'll just look her up, she's well known for people who follow the FDA, is being incredibly friendly to industry. She actually was floated, her name was floated by the drug industry when Obama came into office to have her become the FDA commissioner. And so she has never been seen as someone who's, you know, an enemy of the pharmaceutical industry.
Well, Paul Thacker, I want to thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Paul Thacker is former Senate investigator. He's currently a fellow at the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics at Harvard. You'll find a link to follow him on Twitter and to read his article on Slate.com, which is called How to Handle FDA Rejection. Links are at wordofmouthradio.org. One is the loneliest number, takes two to tango, and three's a crowd. The power of numbers and why certain ones just feel right. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Three blind mice, the three musketeers, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Things that come in threes just feel right. But is three the magic number? And can it be scientifically proven? Blake Cooper set out to find out why threes are so common, so relatable, and so powerful.
The 20th century psychiatrist Carl Jung, the founder of analytical psychology, felt that human beings had a special relationship with numbers. The so-called natural numbers, 0 through 9, have symbolic meaning that goes beyond their significance in identifying quantity, according to Jung. He said that numbers are, quote, peculiar, even mysterious, in that the number is something irreducible. Something which helps more than anything to bring order into the chaos of appearances. It's hard to argue that people find deeper meaning in numbers, especially when a given number seems to hold a recurring significance. If you see a number enough, and your brain becomes attuned to seeing it, you might start asking yourself why.
Maybe that pattern is like the pattern in the stock market, the Torah. This 216 number.
This is insanity, Max.
Or maybe it's genius. I have to get that number.
Hold on. You have to slow down. You're losing it.
Darren Aronofsky's 1998 film Pi is an example, a fictionalized one, of a slippery slope into madness that results from obsession with numbers and trying to find the connections that either aren't really there or are too complex to discern. Because numbers can have this expanded symbolic meaning, culturally we're very aware that there's a lot of wiggle room for interpreting the meaning and importance of numbers. Hold on, that's pretty intense. Let's get rid of that. I need something a little more mellow.
Three is a magic number. Yes, it is. It's a magic number. Somewhere in the...
Let's talk about three. Carl Jung thought that three as a symbol in the unconscious represents action, or movement toward resolution. And there's some evidence of that. The shorthand symbol of three dots, arranged in a triangular pattern, means therefore, a word that literally moves the reader toward the conclusion of a thought. Ellipses can mean the same thing, and it too is usually just three dots. There are also linguistic links between three and words like through and threshold, and the prefix trans in words like transgress, transcend, transport, all words that signify movement and action. Those are just some examples supporting the Jungian theory. But three is everywhere, and it seems to be especially pervasive throughout Western culture. From folktales and nursery rhymes, Three Blind Mice, Three Little Pigs, Three Billy Goats Gruff, to modern culture, and for some reason the representation of modern culture in my mind is the 1986 comedy Three Amigos, but whatever. For some reason, three just seems right to us.
Three in the family, that's a magic number.
Does This Sounds Familiar, a show about patterns in culture and media. I'm Blake Cooper. This time it's three, a simple concept that seems to be, in some sense, timeless. As a rhetorical device, political figures have been grouping things in threes for millennia, literally thousands of years, from Julius Caesar's Veni, Vidi, Vici, I came, I saw, I conquered, to the U.S. Declaration of Independence, and the sentence written by Thomas Jefferson that is perhaps the most famous and influential ever written in the English language. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Mind, body, and soul. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. There are three primary colors. There are three branches in the U.S. government. There are the Three Stooges, the Three-Ring Circus, the Three-Ring Binder. Okay, now it's getting out of control. I feel a little like Max Cohen, the character from Pi, wondering, just where does it all end?
There are endless examples of this. You know, the triangle becomes...
Michael Eck is someone with a fascination with threes, although I feel compelled to stress that he's a rational and functioning person with what seems like a healthy, logical curiosity. He's no Max Cohen, but he still spent a lot of his life noticing threes and somewhat dispassionately documenting them.
And writing them down in notebooks.
In 1995, he took the notebooks online and founded a website called The Book of Threes, threes.com, a sort of proto-wiki devoted to the documenting of threes everywhere. And I mean everywhere. It's quite extensive, with threes from areas of general interest like time.
We, of course, have past, present, and future.
And politics.
Three branches of government, so everyone's checking on each other.
And music.
Symphonic structures are ABA, ABC.
Mr. Eck makes an important distinction about the significance of three, that it's not necessarily powerful as a standalone idea, but it becomes powerful as a concept that, for whatever reason, better helps us understand the world around us.
This is sort of like talking about the way we look at things instead of just looking at things. So it's a pretty weird conversation, but... if you think about color and time, and well, what we do is we simplify, we complete things, and we remember things in these concepts of threes, and that's just how that works.
Part of what might make three so powerful as a concept is how it both remains simple, the way a duality is simple, and at the same time adds a dimension of complexity that perhaps better represents our experience. It's the shade of gray in a black and white argument. It's this, that, and the other.
Another way of looking at it are two extremes and a point in the middle. For instance, political parties that are left and right or liberal and conservative. And then the middle is the moderate place where we hope compromise will one day exist again in our political system.
My logical, analytical mind prefers to think of it that way. In other words, I don't think three is a magic number. Just a useful one, and therefore a popular one, with lots of cultural, contextual significance. And it's a number that's frequency tends to be a little more explicit, a little more noticeable, even though in reality a lot of things also come in twos and fours and sevens, etc. Still, it didn't occur to me to research twos or fours or any other number. Like Michael Eck and Thomas Jefferson and the people who brought you the Three Amigos, my mind jumps to three. Maybe the fixation with three is like a crutch, an easy reliance on a useful tool. Just like Carl Jung's idea of numbers as symbolic archetypes, or archaic images in the mind, which people use to find order in the world and in themselves, we seek out three because it does something for us. It helps us relate, helps us bridge the threshold of shared human experience. It helps us transcend the complexity of that experience, so we can try to find a little order among the chaos.
3, oh, it's the magic number. Yeah, it is. It's the magic number.
That was Blake Cooper from his podcast Sounds Familiar. You can find a link to his story on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for joining us today. If you do like what you heard, there is much more at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us or send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll have more for you tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.